All right, okay, thank you very much. Great to see all of you in person, and welcome to everyone who's joining online. My name is David Erdos. I'm co-director of CIPL, and it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to a joint event, also with the Centre for Public Law. And it's even a greater pleasure to introduce Professor John Penny. We actually go quite a long way back. I think about 15 years ago, I began to know his research as when he was a very impressive doctoral student at the Oxford Internet Institute, working in this topic and also blending legal, technological, social science and jurisprudential methodologies to investigate the nature of our world, our online world, and freedom of expression, chilling effects, and the rest of it. And that work has gone from strength to strength. We've kept in touch a bit, but not nearly enough. But there is this marvelous new Cambridge University Press book just been published on the chilling effect, repression, conformity, and power in a digital age. And it would seem incredibly remiss if we didn't have a bit of a Cambridge launch for this. Mm-hmm. The talk itself will be online. It's being recorded. We won't be recording or we won't be distributing the subsequent discussion. And we hope that it will be of a lively and varied nature. But without further ado, I'll pass over to John, who will talk for about 30, 35 minutes. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Thanks, David. Yeah, it's great to be back in Cambridge. I was just in Oxford yesterday, really cold, rainy day, so I'm appreciating the nicer Cambridge weather, which I know can be a bit of a rarity in February this time of year, but that's good. It's also an honor, of course, to have David introduce me. Really, the research that I did for my doctorate provided not just sort of the empirical foundation for settlement thinking, but feedback that I received very early on from himself, from Ian Brown and others, was really influential in shaping my thinking. And that's obviously been formative in the key ideas in the book. So literally, I may not be here and the book may not have been published without David. I imagine an alternative role where I failed out of the transfer status interview as him, the external examiner. I lost my interest and it did something entirely different, something like that. But no, everything worked out. And 15 years on, I'm here presenting the book to all of you. So it started with the doctoral research. It continued with some additional work that I've done at some of the institutions you see at the bottom there. The University of Toronto Citizen Lab, where I've been a long-term fellow, Oscoddale Law School, where I'm teaching now at York University in Toronto, and Harvard's Berkman Klein Center, where I've been a long-term first fellow, then affiliate, and now a faculty associate. So I've come today to talk to you about this concept of chilling effects. So what do I mean by this notion of chilling effects? Well, really what the word itself implies, this notion of a cooling, even in some cases, freezing effect on people's speech and activities in the face of a threat, whether it's a threat from government, it's a threat from big business, or a personal threat of violence you might face. And I'm going to talk to you about how today we've entered an era where these kinds of threats are being increasingly weaponized to chill, manipulate, and control us. And the challenge today is the way we've been thinking about this concept and the related research and the way it acts and operates in law and in public policy on individuals and in society has been too limited and is deeply flawed. And we need a new way of thinking about it. And what I advance in the book is a new, what I call conformity theory that connects a lot of social science and behavioral science with the concept for a new way of thinking. I'll explain that throughout the course of the presentation. But first, before we get into that, providing some context. What does it matter? Why did I write a book on this topic? Why am I here to talk about it? And you know, as scholars working in today's society, you will, of course, know that it's a highly technological. We live in a world of ubiquitous connectivity. So the smartphone that you have in your pocket, it's not just connected, it's a ubiquitous surveillance device as well, constantly communicating information about your likes or preferences, who you're meeting, where you're going, with large-scale, powerful technological actors who use that, of course, to profit and increasingly to manipulate and to shape our own behavior. Of course, we live also in the post-Snowden world, right, where we learned now over a decade ago, where your governments, our governments, governments with West, governments throughout the world are engaged in large-scale online, not just online, but telecommunication surveillance programs for national security reasons. But even that kind of surveillance, once it was made aware, had a chilling effect, had an impact on our behavior, and I'll talk about some of the research later. But we also live in the post-Cambridge Analytical world, where you have entities that engage in similar kinds of surveillance, data collection, manipulation, misappropriation of information at large scale, not for public policy reasons like national security, but for private profit. We're living in the era of surveillance capitalism, and that's just the reality of day to day. But today, it's not just those kinds of realities. We also face new technological threats like facial recognition and bodily recognition technologies. When you combine that with new forms of surveillance above us when it comes to drone surveillance, or even surveillance that we've now willingly brought into our homes, increasingly with smartphone, with smart appliance and with the Internet of Things, simply appliances are now able to surveil us in the intimacy of our own homes and still communicate information about us to those same profit centers that control and analyze that same data, which inevitably leads to companies like Clearview AI, which the New York Times reported in 2017, maybe the company that ends privacy itself. So Clearview AI being a company that has an AI-driven facial recognition technology that it trained using billions of facial images that it misappropriated from social media companies and sites around the world. So theft of data went to the core of Clearview's business model. But even today, it's not just businesses, right? It's not just government engaged, it's also abusers. Take the story of Stephanie Feldman, who I talk about in the book. She was a novelist who was the victim of a relentless online campaign of harassment, identity theft, intimate privacy violations, who abandoned writing for a period and even gave up publicizing her own work for fear that other co-authors or contributors to some of her volumes would face similar threats. It had a profound chilling effect on her life, not just on her speech, but her livelihood and life. Or the story of Coles Whalen, who was a victim of another relentless online stalking campaign, which led her to abandon not just her home in Colorado, but the passion of her life being her music career to avoid those same threats. But of course, we can't speak about today's context without arriving at the Trump era, which I think speaks to a new kind of moment in time for the threats that I've been. We're not just talking about surveillance capitalism or profit as the motive. And we're not just talking about Snowden revelations, which is about surveillance for national security reasons. We now have a moment where you have government synthesizing state power with the power of technology to weaponize chilling effects, intentionally to chill opposition, to chill speech, to chill any institution in society that can constrain or hold the government to account. And why might that be? So the government can achieve its aims and act freely with impunity. And if you look, I mean, one of the things that you do when you're writing a book, you write the introduction plate. And so when I sat down to write the introduction to the book early last year, I looked at the news and there are a number of stories, all really chilling stories at the same time. The story of Rumeysa Öztürk, who is a Turkish student at Tufts University, who authored one article in the student newspaper, critical of the university's response to the Gaza of War, who was in one of the first waves of aggressive immigration enforcement from the Trump administration, literally snatched off a street in broad daylight in a sleepy residential suburban neighborhood in Boston, not far from campus, sort of hurried away in a dark SUV. If you didn't know better, you would think this was a kidnapping. But it was the beginning of a large-scale campaign of the Trump administration to attempt to chill student protests and student advocacy. And we'll talk about how successful that's been in a moment. There were attacks, a DOJ prosecutor literally threatening protesters at Tesla retail locations at the time. At the time, Elon Musk, CEO and owner of Tesla, was then part of the Trump administration heading up the controversial entity DOGE, which was systematically dismantling key parts of the US government. But it's not just that. Trump went after law firms. He's targeted universities, forcing universities to sign on to new covenants to revise their governance structures. Essentially, as I mentioned, any entities in civil society, in government, any institution that had a history of holding to him accountable, he's gone after, right? And now today you see on the streets of America, highly visible militarized presence, right? And they use social media to make it more visible. And the reason being is that they understand some of what I'm going to be talking about, the science of chilling effects. The aim here is to make it spectacle, is to make it visible, to have a broader chilling effect. And it's working. So protests in the United States, notwithstanding, you know, over a year of brutal ICE tactics, protests have been largely muted throughout the United States. I would say the Democratic Party's opposition to Trump has been largely muted. Universities have folded. Many of them have decided to change course content, change campus rules in response to Trump demands. Large law firms who took up key cases and held the first Trump administration accountable and constrained the freedom to act with impunity, now refusing cases against the government. And if you look at targeted populations, right, so minority populations in large cities, immigrant communities, the research shows that many of them are withdrawing from work, school, and community for fear of facing ICE or other kind of aggressive tactics from the government on the streets. Right? So you can see in America right now, even there haven't been sort of comprehensive studies, but you can see something like a broader scale societal level chilling effect from the government's own, I think, intended weaponization of chilling effects. And in ways, I don't know if you've heard of Adam Serwer's famous essay that he wrote about the first Trump administration, where he said that the cruelty was the point. The line that I've been using for the second Trump administration is that the chilling effects were the point. The aim, almost with a lot of, there's a lot of things that government does, but if there's one consistent government philosophy for the second Trump administration, is that you take steps to ensure fear and chill, right? And when you have that, it allows you to do what you want, right? There's less opposition. You can start a war, you can bomb, you can engage in large-scale corruption as the government's doing, right? With little opposition. That's the aim. Now, you might say, well, that's America. We don't have to worry about it. But what I would say is that across Europe, including here in the UK, there are far-right movements that are analogous to Trump's movement in the United States, which are gaining momentum in every election. I think social media is playing a part in that, but that's a whole other presentation. And here in the UK, just within, I think, recent days, the government signed a contract with Palantir. Palantir, above any other company, really is at the vanguard of the Trump administration's synthesis of state and tech power. Right? This company is literally at the heart of all of these efforts, including assisting ICE on the ground, both in its street tactics, but also its ongoing tracking of Americans across the country, including reports of a mass protester database. Now, that's the context that I'm here and talking about this. But as I mentioned earlier, we're really not ready to take on the challenge, especially as lawyers, judges, courts, public policy, journalists. And the problem really is what I call the conventional understanding of chilling effects, which I tackle in the book. So what's the conventional account of this concept of chilling effects? So it's largely legalistic. It's individualistic, so it focuses on how a legal threat, predominant legal threat, although some conventional accounts that also speak to privacy threats as well. But the conventional view is that you have a vague law, right, that poses a legal harm or a legal risk, and a rational speaker or a rational actor sees that risk, is aware of that risk, and decides, due to uncertainties within the legal process and maybe uncertainties and vagueness in the law itself, makes a rational decision not to speak, right, and self-censors. And yes, that does happen in some circumstances. This conventional account, though, turns out to have a lot of problems. Right? And in one sense, we might blame the lawyers for this. And since we're a room for, well, I'm guessing everyone here is a lawyer, we're going to have to take some of the blame for this. Because the origins of the conventional account really come from legal doctrine, which is where the concept of chilling effects, at least in the modern era, even though the concept predates the mid-20th century, and there's uses that I found dating back into the 19th century in this context. But in the post-war period in the United States, you had the McCarthy era, where you have a number of overreaching statutes that were enacted to victimize alleged communists within the United States. That's what their ostensive personally was supposed to be on the face, but often they were used to also chill and victimize labor opposition, political opposition, trade union dissidents within American society. But the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, invoked this concept of chilling effects to strike down a lot of those laws and ordinances, saying that they had a chilling effect on First Amendment protected speech and similar activities. And so it became entrenched in American First Amendment constitutional law. And the conventional view, which was largely shaped by that early jurisprudence, has traveled with the concept itself, both to Canada, to the UK, and to other contexts, and it's led to a lot of problems. So what are some of those problems? Well, first of all, unfortunately for the conventional account, it has, and I agree with Leslie Kendrick, who argued in 2012, it has a flimsy empirical basis. The empirical basis for this conventional view is deterrence theory. And for those who are familiar with the empirical research on deterrence, we know that if deterrence works, you need a very specific set of conditions to be present, which really aren't often present in the real world. Yes, you can have deterrence in some contexts. If someone's aware of the law, they know the specifics of the requirements and the specifics of the risks and probability that if they act, that they might be punished, caught, and then face the legal harm. But the research shows that rarely often happens in day-to-day life with people in society, right? So deterrence has a very weak empirical basis. Hence, the conventional view of chilling effects also shares those same flaws. And that weak empirical basis has actually led to persistent skepticism. Now, lawyers, especially in the United States, have been fine acknowledging and recognizing within doctrine legal threats, right? Legal chilling effects. But once you move beyond legal chill, when you get into forms of privacy-related chilling effects, when you get into chilling effects that are a result of personal threats like stalking, online harassment, threats that scholars like Marianne Franks and Daniel Sitchin have been writing about for a long time, courts often ignore and downplay. And part of that is the skepticism that comes from the weak explanatory power in the conventional account. For example, Eric Posner, after the Snowden revelations, was engaged in a very well-known debate, often cited between Jamil Jafar, who was then at the ACLU, and they argued about the effect of the Snowden revelations that we knew at that time that the government was engaged in online surveillance. And Jafar argued that it would have a chilling effect. And Posner said, look around society, there's plenty of robust debate, a lot of extreme views out there, radical views. That's evidence that there is no chilling effect. So they don't actually happen. And I'll tell you later why that's a flawed way of thinking about this. So he's a great example of the skepticism out there about chilling effects, especially privacy-related forms. But if you look at what courts have said about the same, U.S. Supreme Court has argued that these kinds of claims, surveillance chill, for example, are not a cognizable injury. You can't go to court and seek redress for them. or, according to the Supreme Court, more recently, too speculative, too subjective, a self-inflicted harm, according to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.K. is actually no different. The Privy Council says we really don't know how real the claims of chilling effects can be. And more recent tribunals have also said there's an inherent weakness in the chilling effect argument. We ought to treat them with caution. I can cite similar examples in Canada, in various common law countries. Despite the fact that you have a growing body of empirical research that is documenting chilling effects in a wide variety of contexts. Right? Part of this is some ignorance amongst lawyers, but part of this too is the conventional view, which itself has this weak basis. The other problem here is the fact that it has very little explanatory power. Once you move beyond legal chill, it has a difficult time explaining other forms of chilling effects, be it privacy-related, be it forms of personal threats and abuse. Let me give an example to speak to the chilling effects of surveillance. And this is actually going to give me an opportunity to speak to a study that I published in 2016, a few years after the Snowden revelations. And this is actually a study that sort of built on one of the case studies in my doctorate early on. So this was a study where I examined the impact of the Snowden-related online surveillance revelations on Wikipedia use. And what I found was, is that following revelations about people, and which made people aware of the possibility of government surveillance online, people were less willing to access privacy-sensitive content on Wikipedia thereafter. Here's a little bit more about this. And this was a study I think resonated, got a lot of media attention. Just a few years after the Snowden revelations, was covered by the Washington Post, New York Times, Glenn Greenwald wrote about it. And part of why I think it resonated is because it involved an impact on Wikipedia, something that we're very familiar with. But also the idea goes to the core of what a free democracy means. If we're going to have a free democracy, we want to be able to inform ourselves about important matters of public policy. And if we're chilled from accessing information on something as common and simple as Wikipedia, if we don't feel free to access information on something as important to public policy like national security and terrorism, which was the nature of the kind of Wikipedia articles that people stopped accessing following the revelations, then we had a real problem, right, for a healthy democracy. So what am I showing you here? So this is a key figure in the study. At the bottom, you see these are the 32 months in the study. The line here, this is the date of the Snowden revelations, which received widespread media attention in The Guardian, The Washington Post. What you see here, the course of the 16, almost 17 months leading up to the Snowden revelations, that people's views of these particular Wikipedia articles and studies were on an increased monthly increases. And by the way, the scale of the study is this. The number of views, i.e. potential people who are captured in the data set, was 80 million over the course of the 32 months. So it's a large amount of views. So as you can see in the months leading up, you have monthly increases. So more and more views of these articles. June 2013, you have a statistically significant drop-off of almost 25% views over the course of that month. And then you see the trend reversed. From a monthly basis, following the Snowden revelations, fewer and fewer views of these articles over those same months. Of course, that's just one data set. I did a comparator of similar kinds of sets of articles, so infrastructure comparator. Popular articles over the same time. So let me show you this. There's no effect from the Snowden revelations. It's just reduced over time. There is no relationship whatsoever with popular articles around the same time. And I also looked at security-related articles. It also had no effect. And my understanding, way I understood the results here, to look back at the main, is that this was an example of a chilling effect from the Snowden revelations. People's awareness and this slow decline was evidence of a rollout of the understanding. A lot of people understood here, but they increasingly over time, more and more people learn of the revelations, understand the implications of online surveillance, which impacts the views over time. Now, thinking about those results, how might the conventional view actually understand those findings? Let me just go back to the slide. And for the conventional view or conventional theories of chili pigs, it can't explain what's happening here, right? There's no legal harm here. And even for conventional views of privacy, that is, there's a privacy harm and that people might avoid the privacy harm. That also doesn't really explain it because there was no evidence at this time that maybe those that information might be leaked, that there was some clear privacy risk here. Now, you might say that's a bit unfair. There could be risks down the road. So maybe conventional theories of privacy can account for the chilling effect in the data. But as I look more into the research, there are other kinds of surveillance chill that conventional, even conventional theories of privacy couldn't account for. And one body of really interesting research is known as the watching eye effect. Has anyone here heard about the watching eye effect literature? Great. So I'm introducing something new. It's really about the psychological impacts of surveillance or observation. And this is a series of research, and there have been a number of studies on point and experimental studies. And in these studies, you have often a set of participants who are assigned a kind of task, a coordination problem, a game where they're dealing with other people. Right? But what happens is they are assigned this task. Some of the people in the experiment, right, in the, you have the control group and you have the study group. The study group, there's a set of eyes that are presented are placed near the participants. Right. So here's an example of some of the watching eyes that have been used in certain trials. So just an image of human eyes that are placed near the participants. And what this research has found, simply by placing this set of eyes, the earliest iterations of the watching eye effect was that you'd have actual human observers there. And I'll talk a little bit about, there's a whole rich history of that kind of research. But simply placing this image of the eyes near the studied participants, those participants were less likely to cheat, more likely to cooperate, and more likely to follow the rules of the game. So with the eyes present, you had more pro-social, conforming, compliant behavior, and you had less antisocial behavior. But what's interesting, it's not just the human eyes worked. There's also studies that showed if you put a very obvious set of artificial eyes, right, that clearly weren't even human eyes, but just a image that's artificial, right? Even that had similar effects. And there have been studies that found, including eyes on signs or walls, actually deters crime nearby. So when you look at the theories for understanding this kind of surveillance effect, this observational effect, and the way these researchers understand what's happening here is through conformity and social influence. Right, but there's clearly an evolutionary psychological foundation. Some of the studies have shown that in addition to this conforming effect, there's a natural, immediate physical reaction from observation by a stranger or by an additional human being who's watching, or even just a set of artificial eyes. Raised anxiety levels, raised awareness levels, in some cases, levels of stress increases immediately from simple presence of observation, right? Leading to this conforming, you might even say, chilling effect. And in fact, what's also being studied here, this actually goes even further back to earlier studies on what is known as the Hawthorne effect. So this is the Western Electric company, which had a plant in Hawthorne, where there's a series of very, very famous early experiments that were carried out, where they found that simply having workers where you had people observing the workers led the workers to be more productive, following company rules, and less likely to be speaking to their neighbor, less likely to be breaching company policy, right? This became known as the Hawthorne effect, where observation changes behavior. So there's a long foundational research to this kind of observational impact. And the explanation for it is conformity. And there's also, as I mentioned, given that physical response, there's also an evolutionary foundation for this response as well. And that includes both conformity and the other foundations for it. Now, to come back to conventional theories, it has no explanation for what's happening. There's no privacy harm here. There's no legal risk. There's no privacy risk. This is somebody present and observing what the participants are doing. So the way these researchers have explained this is through conformity theory, right? And so what is conformity? Well, it's the influence of the group. And what the research shows is that when you're observed, people perceive that as a threat. And it goes back to evolutionary psychology. So our ancestors, when they were aware of being watched, there was a risk that it was a predator, it was an enemy. And if you didn't perceive the enemy, and if you didn't perceive a predator, you were less likely to survive. So it's become an ingrained natural behavioral response, right? And it's linked to other forms of social influence, compliance and obedience, which evolutionary psychologists say it's all the same evolutionary psychological response to threat perception. And that leads me to the theory that I set out in the book, because as I got into the research on conformity, what I found was is that a lot of the key factors that you find in the conformity research, and I'll have them right here: observation, uncertainty, personal threats, authority, and power. So these are all key factors that if they're present, they can have a conforming effect, and the greater authority and power they have, the even greater compliant and obedient effect that you can have. When you take a look at these key factors, they actually map on really well to typical scenarios where concerns about chilling effects are raised and have been documented. So in the surveillance context, so observation, the chill of surveillance. When you think about uncertainty, you think about the uncertainty of laws and government process, which can have a chilling effect on people's behavior. What do you think about personal threats? Think about personal threats and abuse, cyber mobs, harassment, and the chill that that has. And lastly, authority and power. I mean, think about often chilling effects relates to the impact or threats posed by the state, big business, and powerful technology companies. So in the end, what really these conformity factors were really chilling effect factors. Now, my argument isn't that chilling effects are simply just conforming effects. What makes chilling effects different from garden variety social conformity is that we're not talking about, to flip back to those four factors, we're not talking about simply observation by a few people in one of these watching IS studies or the Hawthorne effect studies. We're talking about observation and surveillance, persistent surveillance by the most powerful entities, by the state, who have the capacity to analyze and collect data at scales that today are something that we hadn't imagined prior era. When it comes to uncertainty, we're not talking about uncertainty in social norms, like Moussa Feshari's famous social psychological experiments in the early 20th century in social psychology. We're talking about vague laws, and government processes, and regulations that have the risk of penalty and imprisonment in some contexts. When it comes to personal threats, we're not just talking about a single threat of one individual. In some of the social psychological studies, we're talking often about cyber mobs and relentless campaigns involving coordinated individuals to target individuals like Stephanie Feldman and Coles Whalen. And when we're talking about authority and power, it's not just simply a scientist in Stanley Milgram's famous shock experiment, right? One of the early studies showing the power of obedience of simply somebody in a lab coat and how obedient the participants in the study were. We're talking about the most powerful entities in society. So chilling effects are different qualitatively and quantitatively. My argument is that to understand chilling effects, you need to look at the social science literature of conformity, compliance, and obedience. So as I mentioned, those key conformity factors are actually chilling effect factors. And what are the implications of this new way of thinking about chill? So there's a few key ones. First of all, understanding the impact. This isn't just about self-censorship, although that is an important part of this, right? That's often the predominant focus of the conventional account, conventional theories, and legal scholars. We're concerned about speech, and speech is, of course, important. My argument actually is that it's not just speech, it's all behavior is chilled and constrained, and that has important implications for people and society. So it's not just speech, right? And the scale of the impact, right? The individualist focus of the conventional account cannot conceive and understand the impact on society of a government like the Trump administration using every lever and technology of government, every technology of private sector, and wielding and synthesizing technology and state power the way it does, how that impacts in society. Of course, it also speaks not just to silence. So one of the other parts of the conventional account is it's really concerned about absence of speech, self-censorship, what we lose, right? And again, that's important when people are silent in the face of a threat. But my argument is that chilling effects also lead to more conforming behavior, more conforming speech. It has not just a repressive side, the loss of speech, but a productive side, this more conformity that's produced as a result of these threats over time. And that, of course, has impact on individuals. So if you're one of the key things about we've learned from sociology, Herman Goffman, George Herbert Mead, how people's identities develop, we develop in interaction with society. And if you have these kinds of chills throughout society, this kind of conformity is going to impact on individuals, our expression, our intimate communications, and our personal development on an individual level, beyond our rights, beyond our speech. But it also has implications for other kinds of conforming. Now, when we often say surveillance has a conforming effect, or conforming, we think of people behaving more civilly, more properly. We think of people conforming with polite behavior. That's a wrong assumption. Because if the norm of your group is more extremist, if it's more tribalist, if it's more abusive, right, that's going to be the norm that you're going to conform with, and that the threats causing the chilling effects are going to lead to. So what chilling effects weaponized on a societal level can do is it leads not just to greater conformity, but greater polarization, extremism, and divisiveness, which is what we see in society, which is exactly what Eric Posner was pointing to as evidence of an absence of chilling effects. If you understand the problem properly, it's actually evidence of the opposite. Secondly, explanatory power, right? So if you take a look at those four different factors, just these four factors alone can account for a wide array of differing threats leading to chilling effects. I use this to sort of illustrate explanatory power, but it goes beyond even these four examples, but it provides a more unitary, uniform explanation, more comprehensive account for a wide variety of threats and understanding the responses to it. And it has a more robust foundation. It's not just the empirical research that has been done specific to chilling effects. Now we can connect the phenomena, we can connect the phenomena to the broader empirical foundation and the voluminous research that's been done on social influence, conformity, compliance, and obedience. All of that informs the empirical foundation of chilling effects. It's not just legal risks. It's not just economics, law economics, which has been done. It's a whole host of research out there that can inform our understanding. Thirdly, it explains why power matters, including weaponization, that states can use the psychological basis to weaponize. And that's what the Trump administration is doing. It explains that how governments can impose more threat can lead to more chilling effects. And Stanley Milgram, who was very prescient, who said in 1965, he was worried about the results of his experiment. He said, in the study, anonymous experiment could successfully command adults to subdue 50-year-old man and force on him painful electric shocks against his protest. One can only wonder what government with its vastly greater authority and prestige can command of its subjects. I would argue that's what's happening in today's society. Lastly, and I'll be very quick here, the future of chilling effects, I think, is something I call supervalence in the book, which is essentially new systems that combine AI, facial recognition technology, and personalized delivery responses, both to the subject and to law enforcement. It's being experimented with in China, but also in the United States with law enforcement and commercial retail. And in the future, this is going to have a profound chilling effect. More personalization, more surveillance, and we're talking powerful agencies, law enforcement at the same time. And the key question I'll finish with is, how do we stop? And we stop it with better understanding, which I advance in the book. We have to end our skepticism that's persistent about chilling effect claims, and courts need to be more open-minded about reasonable claims that have an evidentiary foundation. But thirdly, most importantly, we need comprehensive reforms. And people often talk about data protection laws. We need chilling effect protection laws. Fortunately, the four factors that I set out in my theory actually provide a pretty good guide for what we need to do. We need to reduce uncertainty and ambiguity, including aggressive government corporate transparency. We need to constrain surveillance, including FRT bans and other kinds of generalized regulations. We should limit legal personalization within technologies and probably prohibit their use in the criminal law enforcement context. And we need more powerful competition laws, antitrust laws to rein in power and authority within government. And that's our route to a less chilling future. Thanks, guys.